So it is Thursday, October 29, and I'm here at 1526 Hollow Street with Karen Fress. And you've lived here since 1985.
Right.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
What's it like living on Holland Square?
Currently, what's it like? Because it evolves.
Tell
it changes all the time.
Tell me about the neighborhood.
Currently, it's very interesting. It's had a big transformation in the last couple of years. We have a lot of new people moving in. It's being rediscovered, but Union Square historically has had like peaks and valleys. Oftentimes, the real estate values don't peak when other areas are peaking, like Fed Hill or, you know, over on the east side. Union Square is very unique. It's an island, and it's on the west side, west of the Martin Luther King Boulevard, and that's part of the reason why it doesn't have that foundation that other neighborhoods have. We don't have amenities, for instance.
I was just going to ask you, what does that mean, being on the west side and not having a foundation?
Yeah, we don't have business, you know, draws that other neighborhoods have. The only reason to live here is because of the architecture and some of the ambiance, which is born out, the ambiance is born out of the architecture and the history. You know, people who live here love architecture, they love history. You're not living here because the restaurant that you really like to go to is around the corner, or that, you know, there's a great grocery store, or any of those things. We just don't have those yet. And we're surrounded by, and this is what really sets us apart from a lot of other people. People who live here run the whole gamut financially, but mostly people who live here are kind of middle class. You have some a little bit higher, and you have some a little bit lower, but all around us are people who are on a little different plateau. And the people who live here, for the most part, and this is a broad paintbrush, are not offended by people who are different. That they're not offended by people who are traveling on a different plateau. And that's one of the things that sets us apart. It doesn't have to be, you know, that Hilton Head Island perfection kind of. In fact, we're anti-perfection here. And, you know, one of the things, one of the little jokes I've always made is that we're the island of misfits, you know, just like on the little Christmas story, you know, Rudolph? The toys, the islands of misfits. Here we are, Union Square.
But I think you're saying that this is a neighborhood surrounded by a lot of poverty.
I am, in a nice way, yeah.
In a nice way.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with... don't misunderstand what I'm saying. There's nothing wrong with poverty. I'm not saying that, you know, it's okay to let poverty exist, but I'm not offended by it. You know, and I'm not afraid of those people. I don't think that people who are impoverished are bad people or diseased people. You know, I don't think they have any afflictions, you know.
It's a part of the community.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? A lot of those people are way happier than people who have a lot of stuff. So, yeah, it is what it is.
Union Square is beautiful in October. I drove up.
Oh, thanks.
The leaves just...
I know. The leaves are, yeah, the leaves are nice. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
You made a really good point about the houses being the primary draw to the square, the architecture. What drew you to the neighborhood above?
Okay. My husband is actually an agronomist, and I don't want to give you our whole boring history, but before we lived here, we lived up in New Jersey. We lived other places before that, but when we lived in New Jersey... We were doing some continuing education classes, and of course, my husband always won the deciding, you know, he was always the deciding factor. Okay, we're going to study. I never won that argument. So we didn't study the things that I wanted to study, but architecture was one of the things that he wanted to study. And he was really very good at it. I don't remember because it's been so many years now. It has to be, well, we've been here 30 years, so I'm sure it's, you know, 31, 32 years ago we were in school for this. And I don't remember the circumstance. All I remember is that he won a statewide award for his architectural design and engineering. And I don't remember why, and I don't even know that we knew that there was any kind of competition going on, but he won. And I won the prize for creative writing. Because that was, in one of our courses, that was one of the things we had to do. And so he said, well, your building stinks, but you know, your presentation is very interesting, right? So then we had money in, we had invested money in Old Court and Custom Savings. I don't know if you remember those. I'm a little bit older than you. We had money in Old Court and Custom Savings, and there was a sort of a disaster going on in those institutions. And it was a big scandal, a big financial scandal. We had to enter into a contract in order to get our money out of those banks. And my husband wanted to go back to school for his master's degree in international soils. And there were only two schools that offered what he wanted. One was Cornell and the other was the University of Maryland. And so the idea was we were going to move to one of those places and he would go to school, but we had to buy a house because of this money thing. Anyhow, we chose the University of Maryland and we had to buy a house because of this money deal. So when we came down here to look at houses, and I had lived here in the 70s because my dad was vice president of Cummins Diesel Engines. And we were located, my dad was transferred down here from Philadelphia. So we lived out in Howard County, and my neighbor owned several pharmacies down here, and I worked for my neighbor on weekends, so I knew about this area. Anyhow, Jim and I were coming down here from New Jersey, and we were working with an agent who was showing us stuff over on the east side, and my husband was just like, no. And one day, we had come all the way down here, and, you know, we were pretty frustrated at what we were looking at. And I said to him, well, I said, you know, before we hit 95, as long as we're headed to the west, all we have to do is drive a little bit further and I'll show you a neighborhood that always interested me. And we were on Lombard Street, West Lombard Street. And we were crossing, we crossed over Martin Luther King, and we were in around the, I don't know, maybe the 1,000, 1,100 block of West Lombard Street, somewhere down there. And my husband was looking up through the windshield saying, now these are houses. And one thing led to another. But let me back up just a little bit because this is interesting. And I didn't know how interesting it was until everything unraveled. As I said, I used to work in my neighbor's pharmacies, one of which was down on the corner of Poppleton and Lombard Street. I did that on weekends when I was in high school. And there was a man whose name I do not remember, but he would come in on Saturdays just before closing. And we actually had a soda fountain. And he had a real thick accent. And I mean, my relatives had accents, so I never thought anything of it. But I, you know, noticed an accent. And he was an elderly man. And it turned out that he was a professor at Hopkins. And he was Lithuanian. And he lived in Little Lithuania in one of the houses across the street from Lithuanian Hall. And he and I had a great rapport. And he and his wife asked me over for lunch one Saturday. And I went to their house, and I couldn't believe it. I walked inside, and all of my relatives, like from the old country, it just was, reminded me so much of those people. Because everything was, it was dark, they had old Persian rugs, they had books from floor to ceiling. It was a little bit musty, but it was profoundly interesting. I mean, you just walked into this place and you had to examine everything for Florida's. Everything was interesting. You know, it just had such great character, that old world character. And from that time on, I always wanted a house on Holland Street. That's where their house was. He turned out, and I'm not going to go into all the details because it's such a long story. It turned out years later, after I moved here, many years later, when I moved back here with my husband, I had a car accident one day. And the guy who hit me was a Lithuanian guy, a young Lithuanian guy about my age. Well, I was young back then. And to make a long story short, I told him, he had asked me some questions, and I told him the story. And he said, oh, that was Dr. So-and-so. He was the poet laureate. This guy used to write poems and give them to me on Saturdays when I was at the pharmacy. And, you know, I had no idea who he was. I just, you know, he would come in and we'd talk, and he was just this nice old guy. And he and his wife invited me over for lunch. And years and years went by, and it turned out this guy was the poet laureate. So that's kind of sort of how we came here, because I knew about this neighborhood. We were looking for houses down here because my husband was gone to the University of Maryland. And I brought him over here, and he said, now these are houses. And this house was for sale for years. I think 3 years it was on the market. And nobody wanted it. It was slum real estate. We came in here. We came with Gil Cook, who was the president of the Architects Association here in Baltimore at the time. And my husband and I just came into this house, and it was horrendous. It was horrible. I can't even begin to tell you. I mean, roaches, mice, grease, you know, every bullet holes in the windows, all kinds of strange things. But we said, oh my God, this is such a great house. We want it. There you are. That's how we got here.
Let's fill in some of the details. You referred to your family. You grew up in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Where were your relatives from? And what do you think, did this neighborhood remind you of growing up in Philadelphia? Was there an affinity there?
Yeah. Actually, funny you should ask. I grew up in Roxborough, and I lived in a three-story brick house. And it was not a row house. When we bought this house and moved in and my family came to visit, my sisters came in here and said, oh my God, you've recreated our childhood. And I didn't even realize it. They were like, oh, you know, this is Gate Street. And Gates, G-A-T-E-S, yeah. I didn't even realize it, but they were right in a lot of ways. It reminds me of my childhood house in Philly. And okay, so my mother's side, they're Irish, and my father's side, they were German. My grandma, my father's mother, she has an Austro-Hungary thing. This is one of those scenarios that people were ashamed to talk about, or they were so hurt that they didn't bring it up again. My grandmother, I found out in the latter part of her life, and she didn't tell very many people this. Her parents put her and her siblings on a ship when they were kids to sail for America because things were so bad where they lived. And she never saw her parents again. Yeah. So I don't know the whole story. It's just, I know that, like, my uncle, my grandmother, her name was Bertha. My uncle Adolf, Aunt Teresa, these people, they all had very thick accents. And this is probably politically incorrect, but I'm going to tell you the story real short, real fast. I have three older sisters, a younger brother. And my brother and I, we often would play together with our friends in the neighborhood. And one of the things that the boys used to like to play, they had these soldiers, these plastic soldiers. And the gray ones were the Jerrys, the Germans. And the green ones were the Americans. And so, you know, the soldiers were always fighting, you know, and the guys would have all these sound effects and stuff. So we grew up thinking that the Jerrys were bad people. And one day, my father had taken my brother and I over to Uncle Adolf's house. And we asked, Dad, why does Uncle Adolf talk like that? And he said, well, because he's German. And, you know, he's dad's sitting in the front seat of the car and I'm in the back and I'm tapping his daddy. If he's German, don't we hate the Jerrys? Why do we go see Uncle Adolf? Things have changed. Thank God.
So you said earlier that when you bought the house, it had originally been, at one time it had been 5 apartments. When you bought it, it was 3 apartments.
Yeah.
I think the Baltimore Sun reported that you spent, that you bought it for $60,000, but you made $200,000 in renovations.
That was a rough estimate. I can't tell you precisely, but it, you know, you start adding things up. Just the big ticket items alone, it will take you, you know, up into the triple digits.
Sure.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
So what, architecturally, what survived and what had to be adjusted for modern life?
That was a good question, yeah. All right. Well, they had outhouses originally when these houses were built. Our outhouses are gone. A lot of people had more than one. You know, they only lasted for so long and they would have to shift places. Some people actually excavate their outhouses because there are always good finds in there. We found pilings or pylons. But we decided, you know, we just weren't going to do it. The garden had been destroyed. It was just, it was a disaster back there. And since my husband's an agronomist and I've been gardening since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, that was our, really, believe it or not, that was our first priority. So we went and took care of the garden. Okay, and then there was a summer kitchen on the back of the house, which was an utter disaster, inside and out. But it housed the washroom. And we left that there for many years, even though it was just awful. And eventually we had to have that torn down and rebuilt. And we even had it has German siding on the outside. And we even had German siding put on the outside. You know, we didn't go with like any sort of aluminum siding or anything like that. But we did not turn that into a summer kitchen. We have it as our sunroom, a sitting room. Mm-hmm. Originally in these houses, the kitchens more than likely were downstairs. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a kitchen per se. It was probably just a stove and some, like a cabinet or something. And the front parlor would have been, you know, the front parlor. This room in which we are sitting right now would have been the sitting parlor. It is currently operating, as you can see, nobody else can, but it's our dining room. The next room back, which is our kitchen, would have been the dining room. And then at the, I believe around the turn of the century, people started adding these summer kitchens. Our house and the Mankin house also, somewhere along the line, added the bathroom on the first floor in the rear. And very few people had indoor plumbing. And I used to belong to Curves not that many years ago. And there was a woman, I can't think of her name right, Charlotte, who lived, grew up on Pratt Street, and her father was a plumber. And I think in, I forget what year she told me, she was, her house was one of the first houses to have indoor plumbing, and they thought they were living the high life. And everybody had to come to see their indoor plumbing. So the indoor plumbing was, you know, really, I mean, we didn't have to put in indoor, we had it, but indoor plumbing was not part of the original design here.
When they were built in the early
1890s. Yeah, actually, this house was 1880s. This house was built in 1883. Modernizing is just sort of rearranging the living space. We did have to update the electrical. We have new heating and air conditioning. Actually, we have two new heating systems and a new AC system. Well, we added the AC. It's not new. It's just added because it didn't have one. One of the things about these houses that I think is important to point out is these houses were built by builders, not architects. But they had a really brilliant design. And they had transom windows. Mm-hmm. And the houses are built in such a way that if you open your transom windows, you get an airflow. Unfortunately, because of miscreants in society who, you know, really can't behave themselves, we have to, you know, have a security system that's, you know, you just can't have anything that isn't bad, you know, isn't nailed down. We can't use a transom system with lovely trees and the breeze that they provide. We have to use, other modern day technology. But, it's a shame because that's one of the really nice things about these houses is the way they were designed. And again, it wasn't designed by architects. It was just designed by people who knew the, knew the science.
Right.
Yeah.
So this house is a mirror image. It's right next door to the Lincoln House. Mm-hmm. And it's a mirror image.
Yeah.
Did you know that when you bought the house? What did you discover about the house's past lives as you moved in?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we saw this house for sale, and we were working with an agent, and her contract was kind of running out. And I think this house, it wasn't for sale by owner. It was Bob Whiteley over here on the corner. His office was on the corner of Stricker and Lombard. And, you know, we had driven by, we saw the sign on the front. I think we got a number. We contacted this guy. And when we came down again to see him to get into this house, he said, well, because Bob was a real slow talker and he had a real southern drawl. He said, well, now, if you want to see that house, all you need to do is go to the H.L. Mencken house next door, and basically you're looking at the same exact house. Well, that's debatable. We did go see the Mencken house, and then we saw this house, and there was absolutely no comparison. I mean, the Mencken house had just recently been renovated as a museum, and this house was slum real estate. I mean, there was no comparison, but the bones were the same. So the past lives of the house, very interesting. I do have recorded history. My husband and I did do some, title searches and stuff. But originally Union Square was not Baltimore City. It was Baltimore County. So we could only go back, and I forget how far we could go back, but then we had to go to county records. And we sort of put a stop to that because of being in school and working full-time and so forth. So, you know, we found out enough information. And ours was very complicated. It was sold back and forth between mother and I'm talking about 1526. Our house, 1526 Holland Street, was sold back and forth between Alice Blondell and one of her sons, I can't remember which one it was, every year, I think for $1 or some such thing. Yeah, it was crazy. Well, they were probably, I don't know, they were probably, you know, doing something unsavory. I'm not really sure. Alice Blondell used to live at 1522 Holland Street. She was quite a character. And when we bought it from a man by the name of Dick Vicens, who worked at the University of Maryland. It actually was owned by the University of Maryland, and that's when it was 5 apartments. They had students living here.
Do you know how to spell Vicens?
I think it was V-I-C-E-N-Z. Mm-hmm. I think that was his... I think his wife's name was Judy, Dick and Judy Vicens. Anyhow, so we knew about the University of Maryland. We knew about the Blondell selling it back and forth, and there was another player in there somewhere along the line whose name escapes me. But in the early years, this house was owned by the Fortinballs. And the Fortinballs were in the box-making business, and the Mankins were in the cigar-making business. Well, I think there were strained relationships between them from the beginning. But at one point, the Mankins decided to overlook the problems, and they asked the Fortinballs to give them some cigar boxes. And the Fortinballs did not come through in a timely fashion for the cigar shipment. And things went downhill from there. Unfortunately, the Fortinballs lived here for three generations, and I think Mankin was not thrilled about that. H.L. worked from his second floor front. His desk was between the two front windows. And the last Fortinballs who lived here had a dog by the name of Skippy, who was at least part beagle. I'm sure you have read the article. You would not even have to know that it was written by Mankin. If you read it, you would have to say, oh my God, that is H.L. Mankin. I mean, the lawsuit is even that he wrote is so scathing. And so it's just so quintessential Mankin throughout. When you read it, you just know it was Mankin. He really had a hard time with Skippy. And the reporters came by and took a picture of Skippy at the front window. I did not know this until one of our house tours, when my house was open and a man came into my kitchen where I was standing and greeting people and offering my cookies. And he said to me, my name is Johnson Fortinball III. And I live down in Southern Maryland. And my grandfather owned this house. And he told me the story. And then he sent me all the Fortinball information, the Mankin lawsuit, article in the newspaper about Skippy. And when I refer to the lawsuit, I'm talking about suing the Fortinballs to remove Skippy from this house. I don't know that he went after them financially. I think the deal was, you need to remove that dog. And there were, you know, other things, you know, the Fortinball business, you know, the box making business. And I think that was on, I think it was Pratt Street. I have all that tucked away in my paperwork. And so that was really kind of an interesting turn of events, because I think it was the following year Johnson Fortinball came up and co-hosted the Christmas cookie tour with me, because you might want to. So Mr. Fortinball the third came and co-hosted this with me because I'm generally hosting it by myself, because my husband lives overseas. And so it was nice to have, it was really nice to have a partner in the event, because most people who haven't done it wouldn't realize it's exhausting to talk to 400 people who walk through your house. It's exhausting to prepare for the event. And then you have to meet and greet everybody, and it's very exciting, and you don't feel the least bit tired until the last person walks out the front door and you close the door and put the lock on, and then all of a sudden it hits you like a ton of bricks. You know, oh my God, I'm dead tired. Like, I don't want to see anybody for 2 weeks. So, yeah. So Mr. Fortinball, about a year ago, contacted me. His sister was coming to town. I didn't know it because he called and left a message on my landline, and I hardly ever listened to that. So I didn't get the message until too late, but he asked if he could bring his sister up here so that they could get my nickel tour. I don't know if I brought this up, but for years, because people have come to They've made pilgrimages. I mean, people have come from really far distances to see the Megan House. And they get a closed door. They get nothing. You know, a sign. And, you know, a cardboard picture of Megan in the window. And as I am from Philadelphia, where museums are sacred places, this is a little bit more than, you know, my mind can handle. So for many years, I have given what I've coined the nickel tour. And I bring people in and I tell them, look, my house is not a museum, but I will gladly show you what's behind these doors and tell you what I know of our history. And usually they're really fascinated. I even started at one point, and I should have been doing it right from the beginning, but I had no idea it would evolve into, you know, such a stewardship for so many years. But in the early years, I had many people coming through the house. Do you want to stop? So in the early years after the Megan House closed, there were, and when I say many, relative to the Megan draw, Mencken is a very narrow draw. But the people who love him, they love him. There's no gray area with Mencken. The people either hated him or they loved him. And I think that's, you know, when people read Mencken, if that clicks with them, I mean, it really clicks. And so the people who've come here, they're really Mencken. There's not one that hasn't been, you know, a Mencken aficionado. They become very passionate about it, my brother-in-law included. As I mentioned before, the City Life Museums continued to advertise the Mencken House long after it was closed down.
So you were continuing to get visitors.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Wow. And you can't ask people to come to your city and give them nothing when they have come to see something specifically, even though it's the Mencken House and maybe not Disney World, you know. I mean, there's a big difference between the draws, you know. You have to give them something. You have to be somewhat hospitable. So, as I said, you know, most of the people were, even though it was the nickel tour, you know, most of the people were thrilled to get inside and, you know, get a little history lesson and, you know, see what's behind these doors. Because so many people think, oh, it's a row house. It's a little rinky-dink tiny row house. And then they come in and they go, oh, my God, it's a cavern.
You spoke earlier of people who read Mencken. It really clicks with them.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know Mencken before you moved here? Did he click with you?
I did not know Mencken before I moved here. In fact, I did not know that my brother-in-law, who is a history professor, and I believe he writes some history books.
Chuck Trollberg.
Yes, John Charles Trollberg, a.k.a. Chuck. Or Chuckles, as my mother calls him, Chuckles. How's that for sophistication? I did not know that he was a Mencken guy and an actor, you know, Mencken portrayer. But anyhow, we moved here, and lo and behold, we found out, and we thought, you know, what are the chances? What are the chances that your brother-in-law would be this Mencken guy, and you're moving into the house next door to the H.L. Mencken House?
So he was already doing that.
He was already doing that for years.
When we moved in.
Yeah, but I mean, we didn't know that. They live in Minnesota. So
this was just something on the side you didn't even know about.
Right. I just knew him as a history professor. I didn't know that he had this side thing going on.
And since then, he's come several times. I've seen him at least two or three times.
Oh, he's been many. He comes all the time.
Yeah,
he's all the time. He does way more than Mencken. He does Branch Rickey, G.K. Chesterton, Teddy Roosevelt. You know, quite. I think he has a 9 character repertoire, but mostly he does Chesterton and Mencken.
So what was his reaction when you called him?
Oh, he's such an easy going kind of guy. He just kind of laughed and chuckled, you know, and isn't that cute, you know, isn't that great? I don't remember precisely his words, but I mean, Chuck never gets excited about, he you know, he just takes everything with a grain of salt.
So did he educate you about Mencken?
Yes, he did. One time he gave me a call and he said, he sort of laughed. He said, Karen, you're going to love this. He said, Mencken said, and it was something that he had read recently, and he said, Mencken said, nobody, I don't know that this is an exact quote, but this is vague memory. Nobody of any good character would ever live at 1526 Holland Street.
That is a quote.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I put that on I put that on an index card and taped it to my front door for a couple of years because I thought that was a hoot. Yeah, nobody of any good character. Well, here I am, HL.
So do you click with HL?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think HL and I probably would have butted heads a little bit. I know for a fact that he did with many of the neighbors who lived here. A lot of people, my brother-in-law included, like to argue with me about that, but I knew my neighbors, the older people who lived here when I first moved here, who were alive when Mencken was alive. And I hate to tell you this, Stacy, but they did not particularly like him. He was highly opinionated. Pardon me. And I think he, you know, I told you on the phone, I think Mencken was a little bit lonely. You know, when you're traveling on that plateau and there aren't other people who can relate to you or to whom you cannot relate, that's kind of a little bit of an island situation, you know? You're kind of isolated. And unfortunately, Baltimore isn't exactly brimming with intelligentsia, that's for sure. And it's gotten worse, you know, in recent years. But, you know, I think Mencken, there are a few people, a couple of people, literally just a couple, Mary Burke, who lives over, and I think it's Burke, first name Mary. She lives over on Lombard Street in the 1500 block, who was a little girl when Mencken was alive. She didn't like him. She and her girlfriend would like to walk to school together, and if Mencken was out on his front step in the morning, they would deliberately meet at a rather inconvenient corner, but they did it in order to avoid Mencken, walking past Mencken. The other person who's still alive who knew Mencken is Bert Worsham's son, Jack. I believe he's still alive.
Worsham.
Worsham. I believe his sister died. Aunt Bert, as we all called her, she died, maybe about 20 years ago or a little less, 18, 20 years ago. And then Linda, that was her name. Linda was the daughter and Jack was the son. I think Linda died, but Jack, I believe, is still alive. So as far as I know, they're the only two living people who knew Mencken. And neither one was a big fan. It's not that they disliked him. I think it was more they avoided him. And I think my impression with Mary Burke and her school friend was they were afraid of him. But over the years, when my husband and I would meet people and just out and about, and we'd say, oh, yeah, we live in Baltimore. Where do you live in Baltimore? Well, we live in West Baltimore. What part of West Baltimore? We live next to the H.L. Mencken. Oh, that old curmudgeon. You know, people's reaction. I mean, they'd start spitting venom. I mean, apparently he wrote things in papers that really offended people. And so, you know, I have not seen what other people have assessed, you know, that Mencken was a perfect gentleman. I'm not saying that the man was not a gentleman. I don't know. I didn't know him. But the people who did know him, you know, that's not the description they gave ever. And I'm not saying that he was a mean person. I think he was just a very intelligent person, and my guess is he was a little bit lonely. And I do, this year for the first time, and when my brother-in-law hears this tape, he'll probably want to just, give me a lecture. But This year, for the first time, during the H.L. Mencken weekend that included a couple of lectures, there were things discussed about Mencken that did hit home with me. And I have to say, the book that I loved, the book that I absolutely loved, was Happy Days. But that's because I live at 1526 Holland Street. So Happy Days, to me, is kind of a rerun of the living history in this house and this neighborhood.
It's a priceless portrait of your neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, I'm living it. So that's the thing, you know, and Mencken was funny. Very cutting, very funny. The thing that hit home with me is, and this this will probably not be heard by my in-laws, so I'm going to tell you. I am Catholic, I'm married to a Mennonite, and I have firsthand experience with religious intolerance. And so when I heard that lecturer whose name escapes me, I hadn't thought about telling you this, but this year that guy talked about how Mencken was poo-pooing the people who were intolerant, but they preach tolerance, but they were, you know, you don't have to subscribe to the same dogma or the same philosophy or the same anything, but if they're not hurting you, then just leave them alone, tolerate them. You don't have to be best friends with them, but and I thought, oh, touche, Mencken. So that gave me, right then and there, that gave me a new appreciation for Mencken that I had not had before. That was really interesting. Because typically we talk about, you know, was he racist? Was he,
sexist?
Other?
Sexist? Was he...
Yeah. You know.
Was he bigoted towards Jews?
You know, yeah. All of those things. That comes up all the time. But who knows what's in somebody's heart? You know? And, you know, you can say things that can be interpreted a number of different ways. I mean... you know, so, but who knows what's in somebody's heart? And, you know, sometimes people bring on insults themselves, or they bring on their own inferiority complex. Somebody might say something to you and you think that they have said something to insult you, but, you know, you've made this in your own head. You've created your own bad energy.
The stories we tell ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you've spoken a little bit about... after the museum closed, let's go back to moving in and the museum being newly opened. Tell me about what it was like to live next to the museum, the foot traffic, getting to know the people that were there.
Okay. There were people living there. I don't know the exact title that the man was given. His first name was John. He and his wife lived in the third floor apartment, and he might have been docent. I'm not 100% certain. But the house was open, I forget how many days a week, and more than likely it was open on weekends. But we were friends with him when we first moved in. And we would actually socialize over there, and we even had a Thanksgiving dinner or two over in Mencken's dining room. And then people found out and said, oh, no, you cannot do that. Well, I mean, my husband and I, we didn't know, you know. And so we put a stop to that.
Let me interject, and I'd like to start with what did the museum get right? What looked good over there? What worked really well?
Well, it was austere, not surprisingly. It had you know, the pier mirror between the two front windows and the valances that went with the pier mirror. It had August's baby grand piano in the front parlor. They had a little film that they would run on one of the walls, and that was in the front parlor. The second room, the sitting room, had a bookcase, a sofa, a red sofa, and a sitting chair next to the fireplace, and then there was a curio cabinet on the wall between the front parlor and that sitting room. And in that curio, there were carvings, wood carvings, that Mencken had collected. The rug on that floor was a Persian rug, for which I had been told, I never validated this, Mencken paid several thousand dollars for that rug, which would be incredible. In the bookcase, it was a long bookcase, was, I think it was Beethoven's Death Mask. And all of these things had those nice little, I don't know what you call them, but those little machines that monitor air and disturbances, like vibrations. And so a lot of people came to the museum, and they saw the front parlor, austere though it was, and the sitting room, which was probably the most interesting room in the house. And then the next room back was the dining room. The dining room had a built-in curio, which originally in the house was the fireplace, but Sarah didn't like cooking in the dining room. So she had it converted to a case, a cabinet.
Sarah or Anna? Anna Mencken, his mother?
No, Sarah.
Sarah, okay.
I could be wrong, but I think it was Sarah. Then upstairs was, I think the only room that was open to the public was the front room, which was basically his office. And it had, his desk, chair, a couple other items. And there was at one time a pair of his suspenders sitting out. And a visitor came one time and took the suspenders. And it was noticed sometime down the road. And nobody ever knew who it was, except that one day they got a package and it was the suspenders being returned. So that was always interesting. But so the museum, what did they do right? I guess they did everything right. They had somebody over there to open the house, but that was only for a short time. And then after John and his wife moved away, it was, they only had part-timers there, and it just was, catcher's catch can. I mean, people would come from all over the place. I mean, literally all over the world. And it's not that he ever drew that many people, but the people who came, they maybe got in, maybe they didn't. Depended upon the day and the time that they came.
And that always bothered you, I think.
It bothered me tremendously. I mean, yeah, you have to be... You have to be a little bit gracious, when you... it behooves all of us to promote our history and our architecture, our art. That's why people... That's what city life is all about. And I always think of, the different cities on the East Coast, I think of them as stores. I think of Baltimore as kind of the dollar store and Washington, Philadelphia, New York is like Saks Fifth Avenue. we're in the dollar store space. Okay? You're not going to get a real good selection here. But they could have a much better selection. I mean, they have the potential. I hate the word potential because that's all you ever hear when you move into an old neighborhood. Oh, it has potential. But we do. We have great American history here. And I told this to the people who started the Baltimore City Historical Society when they asked me to come and be a part of that. And, they said, well, what's your interpretation? I said, well, I'm from Philadelphia where the museums are sacred places. And I said, Baltimore just doesn't get it. They just don't. They have no grasp of their American history. And I don't even need to say American history, their history. Whether it's American history or not, just their history, the architectural history, their art history, their political history. This is not something that ever really caught on here. And but there are people outside of Baltimore who are interested. And again, I'm using a broad paintbrush. I'm not saying that there's nobody here that isn't interested, but you know, when the people in power don't have an interest in getting any sort of momentum, then you get no momentum.
So was there anything at the museum that you saw that made you uncomfortable, that you would have liked to have changed?
Okay, there were, to the best of my knowledge, there were parts, if not all of the collection, that were not cataloged. And people were taking things or giving things. And I witnessed that firsthand, and I didn't think it was right. I never reported it, but I didn't think it was right. That was one of the things. And then another thing that, of course, as I mentioned before, I did not like the fact that it was advertised as a museum, you know, come and have a look, in periodicals or, you know, wherever people found it. And it was actually closed. I thought that was very unprofessional. And the people, some of the people who worked over there, I don't know whether they're, what their arrangements were financially. Some of the people may have been volunteers. Some of them may have been paid. I you know, I'm not sure what. Some of them left a lot to be desired. They would put a sign on, oh, back in 5 minutes. And I mean, 5 minutes from what, first of all? And secondly, those 5 minutes would turn into hours, if not days. There was a girl who lived there. She was a young college student, and she was absolutely horrible. I don't remember her name. I hope I never see her again. She literally slammed the door shut on a lady's hand one time, and I know that for a fact because my husband and I and several neighbors, we were standing out front, and we saw it. And these people came from New Jersey to see the Mankin House. And we were literally standing right in front of the house. And she slammed the door on the lady's hand. And those people were really upset. We were mortified. I mean, we were just mortified. You know, what do you do about something like that? I mean, you know, but, you know, who is picking these people? Who's hiring them, putting them in this place? So, you know, it seemed like, they were, I'm not sure who was running the operation, but I think they left a lot to be desired. On a whole lot of levels.
So you were here living next door when the house closed, and at that time Victoria Hawkins had been appointed curator, and so she oversaw, as I understand it, she oversaw the closing of the house.
Yeah, Victoria came, I think she came on board a little bit before the closing, and I think, I'm pretty certain Victoria was responsible for cataloging things, and Victoria was really the quintessential caretaker. She was magnificent. I mean, this woman really cared. And she did things by the book. And as far as I know, I wasn't hovering over her, you know, all day long. But she cataloged things that had not been cataloged. And she had sort of, I think Victoria was responsible for finding the distillery in the basement downstairs that, you know, nobody had known about. Victoria was the one who pointed out to me that it was Mankin's aunt and uncle who owned 1522 Holland Street, and that it was their carriage house in which, for at least part of the time, Mankin had the Saturday Night Club. That carriage house is still there.
During Prohibition, I think.
Yeah. And I think that the city museums, the Baltimore City Museums, would have been better off maybe with other people in charge. I'm not really sure what was going on, but as I told you, my husband and I used to go to the Shot Tower. It was closed. We'd go to the 1840 house. It was closed. The sign said it was open. I mean, you know, if you could read, okay, I'm here that day and this time and the house is closed, but the sign said it was open. So there were a lot of things going on that just really didn't lend itself to a successful museum run here in the city. And that's a shame. Because we have, like I said, I think we have very important history, and it's, you know, it's of interest to quite a few people. But if you don't know how to market yourself, you're not going to sell anything, you know.
What is the condition of the house been since the closing?
Oh, well, you know, it's kind of. It's kind of going down. These houses, they're old. And, you know, we have, in Baltimore, we have those underground streams all over the place. And so there's dampness in all of our houses. If you don't control that dampness, that's going to do a lot of damage. There have been, you know, telltale signs of, like, water damage over there. They, again, to the best of my knowledge, all that I've heard is there's no system in there whatsoever, no heating, no AC, it's just an empty shell at this point. So there's no humidity control, there's no control whatsoever. I don't know that anybody even comes and checks on the house. The alarm goes off. The Mencken House alarm has been a nightmare from day one. The alarm goes off and, you know, nobody pays attention anymore. I mean, I do because I'm next door, but nobody pays attention anymore because it's just an empty house. And, you know, the people in the city who manage it now, quote unquote, manage it, you know, they didn't contact me. They didn't say, here, if anything goes wrong, give me a call. You know, no information, nothing.
You're talking about city officials.
Yeah.
City representatives.
Yeah, I have no idea. And the other entities who have been interested over the years, the Mencken Society, they came out a number of years ago and said, you know, we're really not interested in the house. We're about Mencken's writings. I understand that. Mm-hmm. And the other people who have been, you know...
The friends, the legacy groups.
Yeah, I mean... you know, they're around, but there's only so much anybody can do. And, you know, it's been taken away from them. When we were talking about the house and what's in the house a few minutes ago, I wanted to tell you this story just because it's kind of funny. Years ago, I think it was after John had moved out. The all the collection items were still in their respective places, okay? And then there was that bookcase with the Beethoven death mask in it. And some local yokel broke in by way of the transom. And I'm talking about the sitting room, which is the second room from the front. And there's a breezeway that leads to the doorway to that the breezeway in from the garden that leads to that sitting room. And over that doorway is a transom. And somebody broke in and went into the Mencken House and went upstairs to the office, the second floor rear room, and stole a dot matrix printer, which even back then was obsolete, an old telephone that was worth maybe $5 tops, and some other junky items, like really, really, truly junk. And then he set the place on fire. I think there are still telltale signs of that fire on the flooring in one of the rooms. But I've always said that if he had stayed in school a few more years and learned any valuable information whatsoever, he would have been smart enough to reach into that cabinet and grab that Beethoven death mask, and he could have his own island. But instead, he's got a dot matrix, a totally worthless dot matrix. So, you know, better stay in school, you know? I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine? So,
going back to the condition of the house, has the deterioration of the house or any problems in the garden ever caused you any problems on this side?
No, except for the ivy overgrowth on the wall. The wall between our houses, the wall between our gardens was built at least in part by H.L. and August. And they have those lovely tiles, the Moravians and the Rookwoods. And those tiles are of interest to many people. But, you know, if you don't maintain the vegetation and the integrity of the tiles, the you know, the glazing and stuff like that, you could really end up with nothing. You end up with crumbled pieces of, you know, pottery. And that would be a shame. The Mencken house has a whole lot of the English ivy growing over there. And that creeps over. The wisteria creeps over too, but somehow or another, I don't seem to mind that quite as much as I do the ivy. Because when it blooms, it is lovely. But, you know, problems, no. I think, I can't remember precisely, but somewhere along the line, in fairly recent history, maybe within the last 10, 15 years, recent, you know, it's all relative, Stacey. I think we found that we were paying, and this makes sense, we might have had wires coming from the Mencken house over to our house, and we were paying part of their bill or something. I just kind of vaguely remember my husband coming upstairs and saying, oh, you're not going to believe this. But that makes sense because the Mencken house was also owned, as you know, by the University of Maryland. Mm-hmm. And they also used it for student housing. So when they were doing some wiring, they probably, you know, ran mm-hmm. between the houses or something.
A time when this was student housing and that was student housing.
Yeah, exactly.
Some wires going back and forth.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know that I don't know that still exists in any way, shape, or form. Yeah.
What have your interactions been with the neighbors? You were Union Square president, vice president, marketing director for a number of years.
Yeah.
And there's been a number of neighbors in Union Square members who've been involved with Friends and Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Has there ever been any crossover between the Union Square Association and those groups? Any mutual aims?
The Union Square Association in the last couple of years, they have been, you know, interacting, of course, with those people. You know, interested in their progress and lack thereof, and, you know, the dynamics that exist. But because of the current circumstance, I mean, you know, it's all kind of a moot point, isn't it?
You mean the current circumstance of we're waiting for to see what the city's going to do, what's going to happen with the house?
Okay, like, you could only believe that the city is going to cough up that money if you're from another planet. Let me be perfectly honest here. I mean, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. I really want to believe differently, but I have to be realistic. It's just not going to happen. They just don't have that much interest in history here. You know, it's just not here. And, you know, we have so many problems in Baltimore and you know, West Baltimore that, excuse me, politicians are, you know, I don't know how they think, Stacey. You know, I don't know how they design the, you know, their dynamics, you know, what their approaches to things. I don't know. You know, they're not doing a very good job at marketing Baltimore, are they?
Well, especially this year. That's yeah. been a challenge.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times people think if you just throw money at it, it's going to make it all better. Well, you can throw money at something from now until kingdom come. That doesn't necessarily mean anything good is going to happen.
So what is the best outcome for the house and the neighborhood? And what's the city's role in that and the neighbor's role in that?
Well, my role has been to be, a steward as best I can. I started to tell you, I even started a book and I would have people sign that book. And I wish I had done that from the beginning. As for the outcome of the house, now I personally believe it should be a private home museum. I've seen them in other places because I do kind of like to go to historical places myself. I'm not a super big fan of them, but it sure beats oblivion.
A vacant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Mankin House is never going to have, you're not going to have a Disney World draw at the Mankin House. It's not going to happen. Even in the Mankin Society, H.L. Mankin weekend, I mean, the numbers are dwindling, and I don't see new people coming on board. And I think we discussed that at the Enoch Pratt during the meeting this year. That the interest is sort of fading. And how do you go about perpetuating this? I personally believe that, the private home museum scenario would more than likely be the best. Not definitely, but more than likely. The people who have been interested, in the Mankin House, the organizations, that's all fine and dandy, but honestly, we're all getting up in age. Who knows, I have to move to this location, or I no longer have operating legs, or you never know what's going to come up. For me, having been here 30 years and observing, the traffic in and out and the dynamics over there, I personally would like to see it go. And that way, the city washes their hands and, Mankin Society still gets to come here possibly to have, special events or whatever. And it's the best of the least detrimental, I guess.
Karen, thank you for having me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Stacey, I appreciate it. I do think the Mankin House is important. I think Mankin was important or is important. And I think our living history or history should be perpetuated in some way. And Mankin certainly is in every possible way very, very much important to Union Square. I don't know that Union Square would be what it is had it not been in several ways, had it not been for H.L.
For its most famous resident.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thank you.